listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of September 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Cordelia Lynch, and Dominic Reynolds.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, as the regional election chief is killed in Afghanistan and the Taliban claim responsibility, we ask where this leaves the country's democratic process.
And Adam Hugg from the Foreign Policy Centre joins us in the studio to set the news agenda. Adam, what have you got for us today?
Going to be looking at Iran at the UN next week, German elections this weekend, and some new developments down under.
And we will also later in the show head to Berlin Art Week with Monocle's Kimberly Bradley.
Also, in tonight's episode of The Urbanist, we're riding high in Amsterdam.
It's faster than going by a car, it's faster than going by a tram, and it's nice to do so. I always feel very happy when I use my bicycle and ride along the canals.
Not only that, we'll also get the latest news from Kiev. We'll review the European newspapers. We might even play some music too. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Paul Osborne.
Bashar al-Assad says Syria will destroy its chemical weapons, but he's warned he can't meet the timetable agreed last week by the US and Russia. He's used an American television interview to again deny that his forces were behind last month's chemical attack near Damascus, in which hundreds of people were killed. Meanwhile, the UN is defending its report into the attack after criticism from Russia. The Russian Deputy Foreign Minister, Sergei Ryabkov, says they didn't pay enough attention to evidence provided by the Syrian government.
Those experts, as we all know, departed Syria several days ago, and this evidence is with them, and we are disappointed that there is no due attention paid to this evidence in the report which the group presented in New York earlier this week.
The president of Iran says his country will never build nuclear weapons. Hassan Rouhani says they've never pursued atomic bombs. He's also insisted he has complete authority to negotiate a deal with the West over Iran's nuclear program. Egyptian security forces have clashed with suspected militants on the outskirts of Cairo. They moved into Kadassa earlier this morning. 11 police officers were killed in an attack there last month. Officials say one member of the security forces died in today's clashes. The mother of the man who killed 12 people in a shooting at a Navy base in Washington, D.C. on Monday has said her heart is broken.
Our son, Aaron Alexis, has murdered 12 people and wounded several others. His actions have had a profound and everlasting effect on the families of the victims. I don't know why he did what he did, and I'll never be able to ask him why.
Kathleen Alexis was speaking as officials in Washington promised to investigate reports that an armed tactical response unit was ordered away from the scene of the shooting. Investigators in the Canadian capital Ottawa say it could be several months before they establish the cause of yesterday's fatal collision between a train and a bus at a level crossing. 6 people died and at least 30 others were injured in the rush hour accident. Shares in the United States have hit record highs after the U.S. Federal Reserve decided to maintain its economic stimulus program. It had been reported the Fed would scale back operations to support the economy, but it says it's waiting for more evidence the recovery will be sustained. Thursday is the day of the Chinese Mid-Autumn Festival, but one of the traditional ways of marking the day has been badly hit by anti-corruption measures. Moon cakes are sometimes encrusted with gold and stuffed with shark's fin, but have fallen out of favour. Ben Cavender from the China Market Research Group says such lavish gifts are no longer in demand.
The new government has really tried to take a really firm stance on corruption and crack down on anything that could be seen as being corrupt. We've seen that in a variety of different ways, and mooncakes have traditionally kind of been one of those gifts that's sort of a proxy for giving cash to somebody else. So they've kind of said that's not really okay anymore, and so that's really hurt the high end of the market now for mooncakes and really cut down those sales quite a bit this year.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Paul, thank you very much. It's 5 minutes past 8 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio. Essa é a Mônaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Mônaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Londres.
Isto é Mônaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai a Mônaco, vai a City Check.
From London, London.
London, caralho.
This is Mônaco 24.
You are listening to Midori House, live from Studio One in London. And time now to set the day's news agenda. And today we're joined by Adam Hugg from the Foreign Policy Centre. Thanks for joining us, Adam.
Good morning.
Morning. And we start with Iran and a significant announcement by President Rouhani.
Well, there have been a number of very interesting steps that have been taking place over the last few days in the run-up to President Rouhani's UN debut, which will... it's all shaping up to be a somewhat different experience to the previous years of Ahmadinejad's sort of media circus and sort of outrage, and very much setting the tone under Rouhani for a sort of more calm and measured approach. So there've been some positive steps in the right direction from US-Iran letter of diplomacy to sort of try and get the ball rolling about how the US and the international community more widely might be. It's resolved to believe Iran's claims that they're purely wanting peaceful nuclear power, which obviously President Rouhani announced again.
Dismissing nuclear fears, effectively trying to placate those that are concerned.
Well, they've done it before. They've always made the point that sort of the idea that weapons of mass destruction in that sense would be antithetical to their religious strand within the Iranian regime. However, ultimately, it's not words on that front. It's steps, and so actually, what's going on behind the scenes to sort of see what measures of verification could be put in to deal with that is obviously undercutting what the US and Iran are probably beginning to do behind the scenes.
What's interesting about it is that he spoke as if he had the support of the Supreme Leader, and I just wonder how significant that is.
Well, it's pretty crucial because ultimately the Supreme Leader is, as the title says, the Supreme Leader of Iran.
Yes.
So he's the guy who ultimately calls the shots.
But it's the first time that we've seen this.
Well, it's very clear that, whereas obviously a lot of international observers didn't expect Rouhani to win, they thought one of the more conservative candidates would win. However, since his election, the Supreme Leader has been, accepting. We're not seeing sort of the situation under the Khatami government, where there was obviously very clear tensions between the presidency and the Supreme Leader. This is them working in tandem to try and take some of the heat off Iran internationally, because obviously they are, the Iranian economy is hurting because of sanctions. And obviously this is looking to see what they can do on the diplomatic front to perhaps open that up to take off some of the domestic pressures. And you've seen the Supreme Leader give... again, positive noise, not only backing Rouhani's sort of diplomatic approach, but also trying to ward off the Revolutionary Guard Corps, who have obviously big political and economic weight within Iran. And there are obviously tensions between some of the traditional clerical establishment and the Guard Corps, although they're both conservative, they're both obviously very religious, but there are different power bases within there. And what obviously Ahmadinejad was seen as close to some within the Guard Corps, And the clerics are obviously wanting this more measured approach.
From a sort of point of view of theatre, I guess, we saw, the effect and potentially some would say the damage done to Iran by those histrionic appearances by Ahmadinejad. So how significant is this as we see this UN debut approaching? As an opportunity for some sort of global PR, essentially.
Well, it is good global PR for the Iranian regime. They're trying to draw a line under some of the excesses of the Ahmadinejad period, both rhetorically on the nuclear front and in terms of global positioning, but also there have been some small steps at home that just before his visit last night, there was the release of 11. Prisoners, sort of high-profile prisoners of conscience, including Nazrin Sotoudeh, who is a leading human rights activist and lawyer, and Mohsin Amanazadeh, who's a former foreign minister under the Khatami government, who was involved in the Green movement and subsequent protests back in 2009-10.
And also, Rouhani's been able to update his Facebook status to, you know, open arms to the world as well this week.
Yes.
That was unusual, wasn't it?
A fleeting glimpse to the open web there when the censors got something wrong on their technological side and opened the world very briefly. But to be honest, most net-savvy Iranians have got all kinds of proxies and ways around the government's censorship regime, so they're able to access those sites normally, but it's a little bit of openness, even if not intended.
Well, Adam, we talk about the theatre of Iran there in that UN assembly. Now, something that's not looking as enlivening at the moment as that perhaps that might be, or as significant, the German election. Now, some have described it as potentially the most boring in its history, but excite us with some conversation about that. We're looking at a lot of different scenarios potentially there.
Yes, I think excitement is setting the bar slightly high, but it is crucially important. I mean, obviously, Germany is at the heart of the European economy, heart of the European Union on a political and diplomatic level, and Chancellor Merkel is going for a third term, and she remains personally the most popular German politician amongst the leading figures there. Her CDU, Christian Democrat Party, are you know, ahead in the polls by anything between 11 and 14, 15 points. However, the challenge for her is, can she cobble together the coalition that she wants, which is basically a repetition of the current coalition with the smaller liberal FDP, or does she have to go back to what she had in her first term, which is an alliance with the main opposition party, the Social Democrats, the SPD, who are, you know, flagging in the polls, but still, you know, still the main alternative. And you know, it's not, I mean, it's that the grand coalition idea is currently looking the most plausible, given that the FDP is flirting with not being able to make it back into the next Bundestag. So that's, you know, and even if they do, will they have enough votes between them to be able to cobble together a coherent majority? So it's, you know, that's the big challenge at the moment. And, you know, under, basically, it's a face-off between the leadership of the Grand Coalition last time. So Per Stenbroek, who was the lead face for the SPD in that previous coalition, is Merkel's main challenger, and he's trying to do whatever he can to raise his profile. He's been photographed on the cover of magazines, sticking up his middle finger. He's been on somewhat odd youth shows, you know, trying to break out of the mold, trying to change the debate. However, you know, the German public seems sort of set with Mutti, who's the mother, Merkel as a mother figure, but it's how she can form that coalition and what it means politically beyond that.
I mean, on a wider question than that, perhaps politically, there's been a lot of talk about the idea of European and global leadership within Germany and what it means, and the shadows of the past that hang over that question of how much leadership Germany should take in Europe and more widely. Do you think that's a question that's likely to become more sort of pertinent as the sort of years roll by and as we go into this next term?
I think there's an element about what it means, and I think Stenbroek has been trying to actually, you know, somewhat damagingly for his domestic popularity, to questioning whether Merkel feels instinctively European, whether she is able to give that kind of leadership. And she is obviously very clearly a sort of more low-key sort of conciliator within German politics and within some of the diplomatic circles, but obviously is seen as a hate figure by the streets in Southern Europe, because what she's doing, and this is ultimately why a number of the German public like her, is the fact that she's seen as safeguarding Germany's massive investment in the security of the European Union. I think they trust her to be able to ensure that German interests are not forgotten. And obviously, as you said, historically, there's always been that balance between what's in Germany's interests and what is in the interests of the wider Europe, and have Germany subsuming its personal sort of domestic desires because of the historical situation. And obviously, that is slowly changing as generation meets generation. And obviously, you know, it's the management of this of post-Euro crisis Europe is one where Merkel is trying to safeguard the bank balance and make sure that sort of contagion is stepped down, rather than necessarily looking at sort of grand plans of, you know, sort of, she's not a Brandt or a Cole. She's not someone whose goals are more modest and sort of keeping the country and keeping the European Union together.
A German election, but one that certainly matters across the Eurozone, really, a very significant election.
Let's talk briefly then, if we can, about one more topic and one more election, but the other side of the polling booths. Tony Abbott's getting to work.
Yeah, and this is just a quick little thing, because to see, obviously, you've had a change of guard in Australia with the Labour coalition leaving and the Liberal-led coalition under Tony Abbott coming in. And basically, he's been hitting all his hot-button issues that, you know, he's a controversial figure internationally because of some of the things he's said on women and some of, you know, obviously some of his positions on asylum seekers and climate change. But he's getting to work on exactly some of those issues. First major announcement, continuing to tow, you know, the plan to continue this plan to tow asylum seekers coming by boat back to Indonesia, irrespective of quite what's happening to them,
yes.
Which is obviously internationally controversial, pushing ahead with scrapping the carbon tax, you know, slamming, you know, getting rid of various green bodies, investment funds and whatever. And obviously, you know, despite the sexism allegations, you know, only one woman in the cabinet. I mean, obviously, there are other countries, including this one, that haven't got brilliant records on that, but it's given the politics around.
Yeah, it's a bit awkward, isn't it?
So it's been a challenge for him. And he's, I think he himself is actually technically the women's minister now, which is something that's
some task ahead.
Indeed.
What a varied portfolio he has. Adam, we'll have to leave it there, but great to see you. Adam Hugg from the Foreign Policy Centre, thanks for coming in today.
Coming up, we're in Afghanistan, where the Taliban have killed a senior election official.
From Mali to Martinique, every 4 years, the best athletes from the French-speaking world gather for the Francophone Games. Monocle's Steve Blomfield reports from Nice on the event, which, for the French, is about more than simply sport.
The Gabonese table tennis team is filming every second, ready to send all the footage home. The Armenians cheer on their wrestlers as if they were competing at the Olympics. Chad versus Côte d'Ivoire in the wrestling, Haiti versus Lebanon in the football. None of these are a clash of the titans, but watching a Chadian wrestler thump his chest in celebration as the buzzer goes, hearing the cry of anguish from a Djiboutian table tennis player as he loses a tight set, this means something.
You can watch Steve Blomfield's sporting report and over 350 more films on monocle.com.
Now, on Tuesday, Afghanistan's regional election chief, Aminullah Rahman, warned that security problems could derail next year's presidential election. On Wednesday, he was shot and killed, apparently by Taliban gunmen. That's if their Twitter feed is to be believed.
The murder happened at the beginning of a period which could be decisive for the next stage of the country's democracy. For 3 weeks, prospective candidates for president can put themselves forward to replace Hamid Karzai in the vote scheduled for April the 5th. So how much of a threat to the process could this killing be? Is this the shape of things to come in Afghanistan for the next 6 months?
Well, joining us on the line now to discuss this further is Rod Nordland, Kabul bureau chief for the New York Times. Welcome to the show, Rod.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, let's talk about any wider ramifications of this act. Do you think it will impact on the upcoming election?
Yes, I do think so. And I think it more importantly is what it signals about the intentions of the insurgents toward the election process. While they've opposed elections here, you know, throughout in the past, they haven't aggressively gone after election officials. And this assassination is I'm pretty sure, the first one of its sort, certainly the first one in recent years. And it's likely to be both intimidating to other officials and also intimidating to voters. And already there's some indications that some, like UN technical assistants who work with the Election Commission, have pulled their people back in response to this.
I mean, this period of 3 weeks where potential candidates can declare themselves, it's not a process necessarily familiar to people in other democracies, but there is this three-week process. It's sort of six odd months before the election itself. So presumably, if this is a sort of a warning shot, is it not? At the very beginning of this process, there's this sign that violence is never far away. So this surely is going to affect who and how people will come forward.
I don't think terribly much, really. The new election rules provide anybody who wants to become a candidate for president has to gather 100,000 signatures verified by a photocopy of the person's ID card. 100,000 photocopies, and that's a pretty big operation to run. And only major parties and people with major financing are going to be able to do that on the presidential level. There's also, however, provincial elections and for provincial councils, sort of local little parliaments around the provinces, and certainly a lot of those people might well be dissuaded by this sort of thing. It certainly is an opening salvo, though, in the Taliban battle to try to impede the election process.
And of course, the election is seen as a key indicator of whether Afghan authorities can ensure security as foreign forces prepare to leave the country. How do you think this event will now impact on that and that movement out of Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, it's one assassination, and you know, there are a lot of assassinations here. It's not at all unusual for government officials to be assassinated. It's just that in the past, for fairly complicated reasons, I think had chosen not to go after election officials. I think that they've, you know, not wanted to be seen as the enemies of the election process. And this is a kind of change in that tactic, that they're expanding their attacks that way. And it makes it that much harder for them to have a credible election. And, you know, that may be really what they hope to achieve is to degrade the credibility of the election, the ability of the authorities to put on a credible election.
I mean, the government really has an enormous amount to do and a lot to balance over the next few months, doesn't it? Trying to balance staging this election, maintaining security sort of during and post US withdrawal. And at the same time, we've had concerns in the last few days from a UN Human Rights Commissioner saying that the human rights gains of the last 12 years are in danger of effectively being rowed back, of those gains being lost. That was Navi Pillay. How legitimate do you think her concerns are?
Oh, I think her concerns are very legitimate. I think it's significant that, you know, a UN official was as outspoken as she was, and it's just a measure of how serious the situation is here on the human rights front and the government's lack of commitment to any serious reform on human rights. I mean, UN officials are not famous for making strongly worded statements against the presidents of host countries that they're visiting, and that she did is very significant. And yeah, the Human Rights Commission here has been pretty much gutted. Even the Election Commission itself has been stacked with political appointees. And basically, you know, this government seems to be much more concerned about dominating the election process and the political process leading up to it than in respecting the gains that they've made in human rights.
Rodin Kabul, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was Rod Nordland, Kabul Bureau Chief for the New York Times.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Uit London, du var Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
8:24 a.m. in London. That makes it 10:24 in Kiev. That's where we're going now to speak to Gulliver Cragg. He's our man in Kiev, and he joins us on the line now. Gulliver, how are you?
I'm all right, thank you. And you?
Yeah, very well. Nice to have you with us again. And where would you like to start today?
Well, the big story in Ukraine this autumn is probably even a more important autumn than it was last year when they had a general election, because this year there is the summit in Vilnius with the European Union where it will be decided whether or not Ukraine signs this association agreement that they've drawn up with the EU. So the countdown has well and truly begun to this summit in Vilnius. And it's an exciting story because we really don't know whether or not they will sign it. You can find experts who'll say they definitely will. You can find experts who'll say they definitely won't. It's kind of going down to the wire, and this will really decide Ukraine's future for years to come, whether the country's aligned with Russia or with Europe.
And of course, Russia have objected to this.
Absolutely. Vladimir Putin does not want Ukraine to sign this association agreement at all. And he's doing his best to persuade Ukraine to join this customs union that Russia has created with Belarus and Kazakhstan. This is kind of the first step towards creating a grand Eurasian Union, which I think is Vladimir Putin's dream for Russian influence in the world to be expressed through this grand Eurasian Union. And I don't think that plan works without Ukraine at all. And Russian pressure on Ukraine recently has taken the slightly amusing form of banning Ukrainian chocolate, supposedly on health grounds, but really obviously just in order to sort of give Ukraine a taste of the kind of problems that they could get from Russia if they sign this agreement with the European Union. So Roshen, which is Ukraine's largest chocolate exporter and the 14th largest in the world, you might like to know, is currently not exporting to Russia. And other products were also blocked, exports from Ukraine to Russia, last month. But though those blockages have now been lifted, it seems really to be water off of a duck's back for Ukrainian business. They don't seem to be very worried by these pressures from Russia.
Well, other than chocolate being a classic tool of global democracy, as I always think, I mean, Ukraine is in the middle of this sort of economic tug of war, isn't it? Talk to us about the different economic forces pulling at them from one side and the other.
Well, the economic analysis about the association agreement is basically that it will hurt Ukraine at first if it can't export as much to Russia as it does now. A fifth of Ukraine's exports go just to Russia at the moment, but actually nearly a fifth go to the European Union, or all the European Union countries taken together. What experts say, though, is that Ukraine is going to have a problem if it signs this free trade deal with the European Union, because then Russia will block or put tariffs on Ukrainian exports to Russia, making its products less competitive on the Russian market. And Ukrainian products just aren't that competitive on the European market at the moment anyway, because they're not that good, because Ukrainian companies' business practices are a lot less efficient, without even going on to talk about the problems with the corruption. But the kind of expert line is that in the long run, clearly Ukraine is going to do better if it throws its lot in with the European Union, because the European Union is much richer and has much greater potential for buying more Ukrainian products, and also for investing in Ukraine with direct investment into developing Ukrainian industry and developing Ukrainian agriculture. But it's very much a long view that says that Ukraine would do well by aligning itself with the European Union. I think that people who will benefit a lot more in the short term, actually, from this agreement are European companies.
Yes, and given that it is a long view and perhaps the immediate beneficiaries may well be European, how is it playing out amongst the Ukrainian public? Is this considered a risk too far or the right move forward?
Overall, there's a clear majority of Ukrainians who support closer alignment with the European Union. I mean, in Western Ukraine, where people feel very culturally European, it's a huge majority. In the eastern part of Ukraine and the south, where people speak Russian, people are not quite so keen on it, but still they're sort of culturally not keen on the European Union, but economically they think it makes a lot more sense. So the whole of the country is in favour, really, of the association agreement with the European Union, and that's what Viktor Yanukovych, the president, who in the past was characterised as pro-Russian, has realised, and the political class as a whole, there's a clear majority that are in favour of closer alignment with the European Union.
Gulliver, while all of that very important economic decision-making goes on, there's a bit of an opportunity to relax as well. In Kiev, there's a big culture festival going on at the moment. Give us a brief synopsis of what we might expect.
I do want to talk about that, but I think there's an elephant in the room here with this Ukraine and Europe story, because what we've always been talking about before when I've reported on things to do with Ukraine's relations with the European Union is the problem that the former Prime Minister, Yulia Tymoshenko, is still in jail. And European leaders had said that they wouldn't sign this agreement with Ukraine unless she was released, because they think that she's been jailed unfairly. And it's interesting now that there is so much less talk about that, both from the European side and from the Ukrainian side. But I just wanted to mention that that question hasn't been resolved. Yulia Tymoshenko is still in jail. But moving on, yes, there's this culture festival which is called Gogol Fest, named after the famous Ukrainian writer, but just named after him. It's not actually a festival of his work or anything. And it's something that feels, to my mind anyway, very, very European. It's a festival of alternative contemporary art, theatre, music, street art, that kind of thing. And it's kind of everything you think doesn't exist in Ukraine, because everything mainstream in Ukraine is very, very commercialized and very, very kitsch. And this is all about alternative, cutting-edge, avant-garde art. And it rose from the ashes, having been actually supported by the previous government under President Viktor Yushchenko. Then its financial support was cut. But last year, it rose from the ashes in this former industrial complex called Vidobitch, which is a huge, huge hangar. Which
Gulliver, a major transition there, culturally, and of course on the cusp of big political change too. Thank you very much indeed. We'll have to leave it there, I'm afraid. That was Gulliver Cragg in Kiev.
Now, in the next half hour of today's Midori House, we're going to be exploring Berlin Art Week with Monocle's Kimberly Bradley. We'll also review the European newspapers, and in a preview of this week's Urbanist, we're hopping on our bikes in Amsterdam.
It's faster than going by a car, it's faster than going by a tram, and it's nice to do so. I always feel very happy when I use my bicycle and ride along the canals.
But first, Paul Osborne is here with your news headlines.
The president of Syria has said he will destroy the country's chemical weapons stockpile, but Bashar al-Assad has warned he can't meet the timetable set last week by the US and Russia. In an American television interview, he has again denied that his forces were behind last month's chemical attack near Damascus. Security forces in Egypt have clashed with suspected militants on the outskirts of Cairo. They moved early this morning into Kadassa, where 11 police officers were killed in an attack last month. Officials say that one member of the security forces has died in the violence today. Iran's president has said his country will never build nuclear weapons. Hassan Rouhani has also said that he has complete authority to negotiate a deal with the West over Iran's nuclear program. Investigators in the Canadian capital Ottawa say it will be several months before they complete their investigation into the cause of yesterday's fatal collision between a train and a bus at a level crossing. Six people died and at least 30 others were injured in the rush hour accident. And shares on Asian markets have been climbing after stocks in the United States hit record highs after the US Federal Reserve decided to maintain its economic stimulus program. That was after reports that the Fed would scale back the operation to support the economy. It now says it's waiting for more evidence the recovery is sustainable. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Paul. You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Cordelia Lynch.
Now, Amsterdam is always on the top ranks for being one of the best cycle-friendly cities in the world. It's the main means of transport for most people, from taking kids to school to moving houses. But while Amsterdam is friendly for cyclists, does it offer them too much freedom to ignore the rules? Well, Monocle's Cynthia Taylor in Amsterdam went to find out more.
In the Albert Cup market in Amsterdam, it's the same ritual every early morning. The men set up the steel structures for the few dozen stalls that take shop here daily. But before they can go on with their work, a few bicycles from those living in the area must be taken out of the way.
Yeah, a lot. Sometimes you cannot even walk. Yeah, we make a mountain of it, so we just throw them. Throw them.
Charles van Rijn puts up the stalls in the morning and breaks them down in the afternoon once the market closes. It's not only the bikes that are parked that give him trouble. There's a continuous stream of cyclists riding through the market while they're working, and that bothers him.
Yeah, Holland is a bicycle country, you know. I can understand those people also sometimes, but when you're working, you can also think, why don't you take the street behind us, you know what I mean? You can bicycle free there. You don't have to bicycle over the market about 5 o'clock. And then nobody have a problem with you.
In fact, cyclists are forbidden of riding through the market, but many do it anyway. René Mok sells suitcases and bags here. He says he fears for the safety of his clients.
People are cycle on the pavement, and I'm always scared that when little children are walking outside the shop and they come from I don't know which side, and then it can be an accident or something, I don't know, but it can be dangerous.
It is also René's daily task to get rid of his neighbor's bikes before he can set up his shop.
There's always problems with the bikes.
So you always move bicycles?
Yes, from the neighbors I put them always a little bit further, not in front of my shop. So it must be open. People must come in, see some things and buy things.
Cycling is for the Dutch what walking is for the rest of mankind, a natural skill. They maneuver their two-wheel friend through crowds of tourists, speed past traffic jams, and ride in the historic little streets of Amsterdam where no car is allowed. Cyclists rule the city. They're known for doing their own thing. Waiting for traffic lights or limit yourself to the bicycle lane are just not part of the deal here. Even when you come from abroad, using a bike is somehow part of your integration process. American Jessica Strelek, Spaniard Alejandro Lopez, and Portuguese Ana Philippe have all adhered to the Dutch's best friend and to some of their mannerisms.
I'll slide through a red light from time to time, but I'm probably more conservative than most.
Yeah. Same here. Like sometimes, yeah, there's nobody coming, it's a small strip, whatever, but most of the times I tend to follow the rules.
Yeah, I do it for my own safety. I'm not good at the braking, and with the pedal brake I still get to, so I really need to stop.
Gerrit Faber is an advocate for the Amsterdam's branch of the Cyclists Union. He says the behavior Amsterdam cyclists are known for has nothing to do with riding bikes.
Sometimes in rush hour, some people, they are in a bad mood because they are too late and are in a hurry, and then they're not so friendly. And that hasn't anything to do with the cycling, but with the hurry of the society, and that's a pity.
Faber does believe there's a need for education, and that's why his union frequently organizes actions and campaigns to remind folks safety must come first. But he has no doubt cycling only benefits the city.
It's faster than going by a car, it's faster than going by a tram, and it's nice to do so. I always feel very happy when I use my bicycle and ride along the canals or in the Vondelpark.
Ria Hilhorst is a policy advisor at the city's Infrastructure, Traffic and Transport Service. She too believes cycling contributes to Amsterdam's friendly air.
The atmosphere in the city is relaxed thanks to all the bicycles, because it's quiet. A bicycle doesn't make any noise, doesn't have air pollution. It's peaceful. So I think that makes people relaxed. And the other thing is that when you're on a bike, you have easy contact with each other, so you can talk.
Hilhorst refutes the idea cyclists think they rule town. It's more of a local mentality, she says.
Amsterdamers call themselves anarchistic, and that's already since years and years, even since centuries. Even 100 years ago, when the bicycle was just a new invention, even then people behaved like this, more or less.
Both Hilhorst and Faber add that drivers will have the same behavior. But when you're on a bike, you're more flexible in your movements and can easily steer away from trouble. Like any other, they'll also admit to not always stopping at a red light or to riding through a street they're not supposed to. Foreigners Jessica, Alejandro and Anna assure cyclists here aren't as bad as one might paint them.
I've definitely had a couple encounters which were not friendly. I think some of them were caused by my inexperience in biking. But overall, I do think cyclists are pretty friendly. And you have to engage on a more human level, just because you're looking at them directly and you actually see the person instead of through like a glass windshield or through a tram window. So
Yeah, I agree. Like sometimes you have like you have these guys ringing the bell. They're a little bit aggressive. But I, you know, what really annoys me are the guys on scooters. I think those are the rudest guys. Like they are like, get out of the way. I'm on my scooter. Blah blah. It's like, you know, dude, just wait for me.
I think it's the same. There are some cyclists that just want to go over. You know, if you have a car stopped, a lot of bikes stopped, they just want to go. They don't wait for you. But it's just, that's okay. I think the scooters are even worse.
Bike traffic in Amsterdam has increased 40% in the last 20 years and is showing no signs of slowing down. Hilhorst agrees there are measures to be taken to ensure the city remains a safe place when it comes to traffic. Plans include enlarging the bike lanes in the busiest routes and adding some 40,000 new racks to the existing 250,000 in public spaces. It still won't be enough for all the 800,000 bikes in the city, though, especially around train stations, where space has become very limited. But despite the bad reputation and the clutter of bicycles at someone's doorstep, locals seem to agree that there's no place like home when you're riding a bicycle through the streets of Amsterdam. For Monocle, I'm Cynthia Taylor in Amsterdam.
You're listening to Midori House. Thank you, Cynthia. We'll be back right after this to explore Berlin Art Week.
Aperitivo is the latest addition to the Monocle 24 lineup. Airing every weekday at 1800 hours London time, Aperitivo is the perfect way to digest the day's biggest stories. From our studios at Midori House and over a flat white with special guests at the Monocle Cafe, we'll feature a relaxed blend of conversation and analysis that you simply won't hear anywhere else. That's Aperitivo, airing every weekday at 1800 hours London time. Brought to you in association with the Glenlivet.
It's 8:41 a.m. here in London, 7:41, it's a hard time to say, in Berlin, where we head now. And it's that time of year again where cities around the world host more culture, design and fashion events than you can shake a very well-crafted mahogany stick at.
Got plenty of those. Always shaking the mahogany stick.
I've got a few.
Sorting the wheat from the chaff on this, of course, is a tricky process, just like pronouncing the time. but it's a safe bet that Berlin, where a vibrant, creative community exists all year round, puts on a good show come September. It is Berlin Art Week, and joining us on the line from the city is Kimberly Bradley. Hello to you, Kimberly.
Hello. It's 9:40 here, though, not 7:40.
My goodness.
Dear. Well, I'm shaking my well-crafted mahogany stick at someone through the glass now. There's big time troubles on the show today. Okay, well, thanks for that time check. At least we've got that sorted. Tell us, what's the city like in the midst of this art week? What should we be going to see, do you think?
Oh, there's a tremendous lot to see. First of all, today, ABC Art Berlin Contemporary opens. That's a very interesting hybrid of art fair and exhibition that started in 2008. It used to be an off fair. To our main fair, which got canceled in 2011. There are museum shows that are all coordinated this year. It's a collaborative effort by about 10 museums called Painting Forever! And at Kunstwerke, for example, which is the contemporary art center here, there are, I think, 80 people in that show. It's a great big group show. There's a much smaller show at the New National Gallery of four very prominent painters in the city. Franz Ackermann has 4-meter paintings at Berlinische Galerie, and plus all of the galleries and off spaces are just celebrating everything. So it's good fun so far.
And Kimberly, essentially this has replaced an older art fair that came before it. How is the transition being felt? Do people feel this is a more modern, innovative art fair?
Actually, yes. I mean, before, the city really wasn't terrifically involved in what they used to call Berlin Art Fall. It was more gallery-driven, and there was one main art fair that was administered by the Fairground administration here. It was called Art Forum Berlin. And that because of a lot of infighting and the lack of a collector base here, that got canceled in 2011. And there was a group of art world prominent people here that got together Christmas of that year. I know this story because a friend of mine is one of them. And just had little discussions as to what could be an alternative. The art world here is huge. We've got tons of emerging artists. We've got more and more celebrity artists living here, great institutions, but nothing was coordinated.
Yeah, it seems surprising because, of course, everyone kind of considers Berlin to be synonymous with new art forms and a great cultural vibrancy. So the idea that they can't sort of organize themselves enough to produce an impressive art fair previously is quite surprising.
Yeah, and what happened is this group went to the city, and so now the city's behind this. The city senate, the Department of Economics, as well as the cultural chancellery, is supporting this. And so it's a much more cohesive event that I think is easier. For example, you're a tourist from London, just an art lover from somewhere else. You've got things in a nice package in this week, which is fantastic. They've got really organized events. But plus this alternative thing is still happening parallel to that.
And how does a city get around the fact that, as you say, there wasn't at one point the collector base to support a fair? How have they sort of managed to, I guess it's sort of chicken and egg situation, isn't it, to drum up that collector base in order to support a fair like this?
I think Berlin Art Week is a step in that direction by getting collectors to come here for this event, promising them a really good time, you know, in all the museums, in all the galleries. There's another event in the springtime called Berlin Gallery Weekend, which has become over the past 9 years something else that allows collectors to come here. I mean, growing a homegrown collector base is a long-term project. And the one thing I have heard is that the technology industry that's setting up here now has kind of spawned a few younger collectors. That's a brand new development. So a lot of the gallerists here end up making a lot of their sales at Art Basel, at other fairs in other cities. But we're working on it. We're working on getting people to come here.
Yeah. And of course, you talk about that domestic industry. What about international influence coming in?
In terms of artists?
Yeah. Do you find, because of course, when we've seen in Asia these enormous art fairs that often attract, you know, multi-millionaires, this is more of a concentrated domestic art fair, is it?
This is more regional. Yeah, definitely. It's also still not considering itself a full art fair, which is
It's a half fair.
It's got its own kind of hybrid. It demands to be considered curated. What I'm seeing in the past couple of years in terms of people moving here, you've got people with more money clearly through the tech industry, but you've also got very famous artists that are moving here, like Douglas Gordon, or he's the Scottish Turner Prize winner.
Yes.
Matt Mullican is a pretty prominent American. Tomas Saraceno, who has huge museum shows everywhere. And these are new residents. And that kind of ups the cachet, I think, of the overall art world. And I have to just see what happens. I would say in the next 5 years, things could really solidify.
Okay, Kimberly, well, I'm sure you will be keeping your well-trained eyes on the show this week. I'm sure we'll talk to you about it again. Kimberly Bradley there in Berlin for us.
Up next, we'll be reviewing the European newspapers, but first, some music. Here's Everybody Wants to Rule the World by Tears for Fears.
That was Tears for Fears with Everybody Wants to Rule the World. Of course it was. Memories of Independence Day for you, Cordelia.
Yeah, some strong ones.
Yeah.
I watched that film on loop for about a year. So I don't know, it was a bit of a harrowing listen.
I think it's still very powerful, even today. Great tune. You're listening to Midori House with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Cordelia Lynch. Time now to look through this morning's European newspapers. Alexa Firmenich is here. Alexa, how are you?
Very well. How are you?
Yeah, very good, thanks. We've got a range of stories, I guess, centred in Switzerland, but we'll start with Le Monde.
Yes, so there's a story in Le Monde today that, well, what's going on in Syria is actually attracting a new generation of jihadists from France. The government's estimated that there are around 350 French either on their way, having returned, or being involved in some way with the conflict in Syria. And they're being tempted by easy access to the country. So what they do is they take low-cost flights to Turkey. And then through connections they made through the internet or otherwise, they cross into the border with Syria. And there's concerns that they're being radicalized. And they fear that when, you know, these guys come back into France, that they might... you know, started doing things there.
Certainly a domestic fear in Britain as well, with recent jihadi videos emerging, and Syria, of course, being one cause, they say, of that radicalisation. With this French example, is Syria meant to be that crucial influence?
I think it is. And I think that they've seen an upswing, especially after the gas attacks, which sort of gave people a reason to rally behind some sort of cause, a holy war. And actually, the senior judge in charge of investigating terrorism, Marc Trevidic, he said that actually Islam appears now more like an ideology. So sort of what communism was like in the 60s and 70s to some of these French, then a religion. So they're sort of using it as an outlet for these frustrations that we've talked about many times in France.
And are these young, disaffected Muslims that have perhaps come to the religion later, are these men with already very strong, consolidated views about the religion?
I think there's actually a bit of both. They mentioned both types of groups in the article, and right now they're just keeping an eye on them, the security apparatus, and I think it's just to keep an eye on how it'll unfold.
Well, that's, I guess, the question which always follows when you see headlines about radicalization and particularly things with a foreign, a foreign route potentially coming back into over the borders into the country, that the question is, what sort of surveillance comes next? What sort of eyes do you keep on these people? Is that a discussion that's being had?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And actually, maybe I'll go to the Swiss news now. It's a rather grim story, but it's honestly quite a big story in Switzerland. In Switzerland, actually, we have... we don't have a standardized nationwide justice system, and it's come under scrutiny very recently, because last week there was a convict who was convicted for 20 years, and he escaped from the prison and kidnapped / killed his therapist. Basically, they were out on their way to a weekly horse riding session, which is seen as a way to rehabilitate him, or rather to get him ready for rehabilitation once he's back in society. Mm. And they stopped at a knife shop because he'd been given permission to buy a knife to clean out the horse's hooves. Mm. And apparently he bought another type of knife. And her body was found the following day. He'd obviously escaped. And a few days later, he was found at the German-Polish border.
So now calls for more restriction and a monitoring of those that are released.
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge debate about how we should punish offenders and how we should treat them while they're serving their sentences. Right now, we have a policy of being quite lenient and giving them a lot of liberties because it's seen as a sort of carrot and stick approach. And especially in the French-speaking part of Switzerland, this is something that we tend to do quite often. And this is the third murder in fourth year with similar situations. Mm.
I mean, and again, and from a similar direction, I guess, to the terrorism and jihadism issue we were talking about just now. Presumably, then there are questions about how you keep track of certain people, databases for sex offenders, presumably on the way.
Yeah, we actually don't have a nationwide database for sex offenders, and our justice minister says that she's opposed to it because it's difficult to classify what is a dangerous criminal. And, you know, once you put under that banner, you have a lot of restrictions in your life if you're a criminal. So I don't know. I think that it's an ongoing debate. And I mean, it's a larger debate as well about how do you treat prisoners? I know that lots of different countries see this in different ways. And some people say that prison sentences are of limited merit.
And Switzerland sends very few people to prison, at least violent offenders, relatively speaking. Right?
We're, I think, out of all the European countries, probably the one that does that the least. I'm not quite sure why historically, but Yeah, I mean, we'll see. I think that a situation like this now, this got a lot of scrutiny. So it's definitely pressure's mounting.
Moving on now to another story and a right-wing politician passing a motion about the way visitors should be greeted in the country.
Yeah, this is kind of a silly story from the right-wing Swiss People's Party. Thomas Mindler, who is an initiator of this law to better protect the concept of Swissness.
Aha, Swissness.
Mm, yes.
Hard to define, or?
Hard to define, maybe, but I mean, there's a few images, right? Chocolate, cheese, cows,
I wasn't
going to
say that. I thought we could move past these like yeah. simple cultural stereotypes, surely. Is that really what Swissness is all about?
I mean, we have high-tech technologies and watches, but what he wanted was he wanted to propose a motion to greet important visitors to the country, so politicians, presidents, etc., not with a sort of military parade and military honours as we do now, but with St. Bernards, which is our sort of traditional mountain dog.
Back to the pastiche then.
Yeah. And folkloric groups. And he says that this is a lot more about what Swissen is about than presenting a, I quote, stiff and shaven soldiers.
I see. And does he think that in turn with this, that it's going to promote tourism, the St. Bernard dog might get the tourists flooding in?
I don't know. I think it's just more a case of wanting to present a sort of friendly, approachable, cute vision of Switzerland. But it was defeated 36 voices to one. So I think that shows it's not very popular.
Dead in the water, really, before it even began.
Definitely dead.
Ouch. Alexa, thank you very much for that range of stories with a Swiss tinge this morning. Alexa Firminich there with the European Papers.
Well, that's all we have time for today, I'm afraid. Thanks to our producers, Alla John, and our researchers, Alexandra de Kramer and Matt Alagaya, and our studio manager, Alex Funnell.
Rob Bound is up after the news with Culture, and Cordelia and I will be back with Midori House at exactly the same time tomorrow. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.